I'll be reading from Hebrews, excerpts from chapters 11 and 12, stories of faith. By faith we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen was made from things that are not visible. By faith, Noah, warned by God about events as yet unseen, respected the warning and built an ark to save his household. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to set out for a place that he was to receive as an inheritance. And he set out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he stayed for a time in the land he had been promised, as in a foreign land, living in tents. By faith, he received power of procreation, even though he was too old. And Sarah herself was barren, because he considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one person, and this one as good as dead, descendants were born, as many as the stars of heaven and as the innumerable grains of sand by the seashore. By faith, Jacob, when dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph. By faith, Joseph, at the end of his life, made mention of the exodus of the Israelites and gave instructions about his burial. By faith, Moses was hidden by his parents for 3 months after his birth because they saw that the child was beautiful and they were not afraid of the king's edict. By faith, Moses, when he was grown up, refused to be called a son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to share ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the fleeting pleasures of sin. He considered abuse suffered for the Christ to be greater wealth than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking ahead to the reward. By faith, he left Egypt, unafraid of the king's anger, for he persevered as though he saw him who is invisible. By faith, the people passed through the Red Sea as if it were dry land. But when the Egyptians attempted to do so, they were drowned. By faith, the walls of Jericho fell after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith, Rahab the prostitute did not perish with those who were disobedient because she had received the spies in peace. And what more should I say? For time would fail me to tell of Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, obtained promises, shut the mouths of lions, quenched raging fire, escaped the edge of the sword, won strength out of weakness, became mighty in war, put foreign armies to flight. Women received their dead by resurrection. Others were tortured, refusing to accept release in order to obtain a better resurrection. Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and the sin that clings so closely, and let us run with perseverance the race that is set before us, looking to Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of our faith, who, for the sake of the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, disregarding its shame, and has taken his seat at the right hand of the throne of God.
In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, plants, earth,
you,
all in this perfectly balanced relationship
with God,
but with you in on things with God in a special way,
with you holding some extra power and responsibility to maintain the balance of all those relationships.
Enter Adam and Eve, stage right. Like I said, everything's in balance, paradise. But there's one tree that they technically could eat from but shouldn't, because they're supposed to remember that they don't need it, that God loves them, and God's got their back.
But they get scared that they don't have enough or won't be enough without it, so they eat from it. Just like we all do, every single time we do something to grab more than we need or have. It's kind of a depressing start to the story, but that's how stories start. There's an initial conflict, and ours is the granddaddy of all initial conflicts. People get scared, and so they do what they know they shouldn't, and they don't do what they know they should. And, well, when people do what they know they shouldn't, paradise isn't paradise anymore. That's just common sense.
So sure, God's disappointed. But God doesn't leave them there. He doesn't leave Adam and Eve hiding in the bushes. God calls them right out of those bushes and invites them back into open and vulnerable relationship. Then God walks right out of paradise with them and straight into the muck of life after bad decisions.
And God hatches a plan. God works in this personal, intimate way, so God hatches a plan with one particular couple, Abraham and Sarah.
God says, "Friends, I'm putting together a team that will heal the whole world. I'm the owner, but you got to be the general manager. You got to find a place for this team to play, and you got to start finding players. And I don't want you to do this at home. You got to grow this team in a strange land."
So Abraham and Sarah, by straight faith, march right over to this strange land and start growing this team. Not perfectly, mind you, but organically, they make babies. It's the nucleus of the family team. It's family. For God so loved the world that he told this aging, barren couple to go ahead and start a family.
And that family grows a little. Enter Joseph. Joseph is the all-star on the team for a full generation, the clear MVP. But he wears his all-star jersey around the clubhouse a little too often, and his brothers sell him into slavery, bound for Egypt.
Joseph's an alien in Egypt, but he's still an all-star, so he rises to the top there too. He even makes the Egyptian team stronger, and then, years later, his brothers show up.
The team hasn't been doing so well.
Without their MVP, they didn't see this famine coming.
And they need food. Food that Joseph's been stockpiling.
He gives them everything they need.
Hugs.
Tears.
They make up.
And as a result, we get a little glimpse of God's big plan fighting its way to the surface for a moment. Plain and simple, it's a taste of the way God's kingdom's gonna be someday.
And everyone's feeling so good about it that the whole family comes to Egypt, and the family tree grows like crazy. So the family's so big, it's a people now. The team is a whole people now.
So the team keeps growing and time goes by.
Joseph's in the Hall of Fame, but the Egyptians don't care. And eventually, all the Egyptians see is a foreign family tree growing bigger and bigger on their land. So things start to get ugly for the team.
At its worst, the Egyptians start killing all the team's baby boys.
And that's when Shipra and Pua, two heroic midwives, run a little interference, keeping baby boys alive behind Pharaoh's back.
Meanwhile, a mom has a baby, Moses, the people's next generational all-star.
And to save him, she risks her life, puts him in a basket on the river, and then Pharaoh's daughter finds him and decides she's got to care for this kid.
And let's just pause here for a second. Right before Moses does his big thing, sometimes the shorter we make this story, the less we talk about all the women on this team. But they're there. Watch closely, because this story goes nowhere without them.
So Moses is near the top now. And this is when God steps in to tell him the team's got to relocate again. And Moses has got to become the new manager to get them there. Moses doesn't want to do it. But God's got plans. God can't let this team get killed off by an angry Pharaoh. They are the ones that God needs to bless everyone and everything through. So, plagues, departure, parting waters, dramatic escape. You've seen the movie. So,
God takes the team out into the wilderness for extended spring training. God gets really hands-on about it too, almost co-coaches with Moses sometimes. Gives them a lot of tips for becoming the kind of team that will fulfill its destiny. God gives them the Ten Commandments, more. God, Moses, and the team develop a playbook of sorts. If this, then this. This is what it looks like when the team's playing well. This is what it looks like when the team's not playing so well. As happens with training, there's some bluster and some posturing. You're going to get killed if you play that way, son. It's the kind of training we should expect from a time and place where death is perhaps the most evident part of life. And it's the tone of a playbook that knows that the goals and the stakes couldn't be any higher. It's a playbook for the big game.
But before they play in the big game, the team also needs to get into the big leagues, the promised land. But just when they think that they're ready, it becomes clear that they need a lot more training.
But God's also a generous trainer. God rides them hard, but God's also got this intimate compassion for them. The Lord is my shepherd. He makes me to lie down on green pastures, the players recall. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine, they whisper.
And so it's decades of more training, learning this hard lesson from a loving coach. Listen, team, you don't get into the promised land until you trust that I love you so desperately that I'm going to take care of you.
So, finally, the next generation gets their crack at the promised land, and lo and behold, they get it.
It's a crushing victory.
They can barely believe they won.
God is on our side.
For God so loved the team, he transformed them from a homeless, terrorized people into their very own promised landowners.
But what if... Yeah, and I know this is a high point here, but just humor me for a minute. What if we slipped another story in here? You see, before all this, before when the team's spies went to get the lay of that promised land, the strangest things happened. These spies shack up with this prostitute, Rahab. So the local soldiers, they get wind of things, and they know just where to look. So they're pounding on the prostitute's door. And Rahab, despite the fact that these spies are here as part of a plan to torch her city, she hides them.
And just like with Joseph and his brothers, amidst what should be a moment that celebrates violence, we all get another little glimpse of some bigger plan, a plan for a kingdom of peace, fighting its way to the surface, just for a moment. Because remember this, getting your own promised land to set down roots in is a short-term plan. This gracious prostitute is a hint of the big game to come when God will use the team to give homes to everyone. Someday. For God so loved the team that he gave them to what they assumed was nothing more than a heathen prostitute to protect and care for them when they couldn't care for themselves. There's also that. There's no way around it.
So now they've got their very own land. And now the family tree can really spread its roots. Spring training is over, and they're all in the big leagues now.
Except here's the thing. Once you're in the big leagues, you got big league expectations. Do you deserve this?
Well, who could?
Will you get cocky?
Who couldn't?
Will you stay on top of your game?
Good luck.
Will you be able to stay in this promised land?
Only if you stay on top of your game.
Abuse this privilege, and this blessing could become a curse real fast. You'll wish you were still slaving away in Egypt's minor league, so don't throw those playbooks away. Keep them fresh. For God so loved the team that he gave them the kind of playbooks that could keep them on this track as long as they used them diligently.
So you're in the big leagues, and your team is unstoppable, and you're remembering all those playbooks, but... will you remember Abraham? Weird question, right? But will you? Will you remember Abraham and God and the start of this team? And the fact that this team wasn't built to win the league for themselves, but to somehow change the league itself until every team was a winner?
Like anyone's gonna remember that, right? There's a league to win here, and those teams, they'll do anything to win. They'll stab your babies while you're still pregnant with them if it gives them better odds. God's deal with Abraham sounds nice, but this isn't Woodstock, folks. This is the big league.
And so the team does what a team does. It nominates leaders who will look after its protection and dominance. At first, the leadership process is pretty primitive. Have a few good games and it could be you for a while. But the longer that the team's in the big leagues, the more they start to notice anything that might be giving another team an advantage.
The other teams, they each have this really clear leader with a really clear system in place to make sure that that leader can maximize their strength and stability.
Now, it's hard to believe that the team forgets this until you remember how often you forget this, and then you remember that it's easy. But the team forgets that they have a secret weapon that makes all that formal leadership stuff irrelevant. They have God of course. And God's got a plan, and God's plans always happen in God's time and in God's ways. And remember spring training? This is God's team. And lesson number one is I love you, and lesson number two is I've got your back.
But they forget. God should be hurt, but mostly God recognizes that this isn't a problem right now. They can run their team like a kingdom and grow like one too. The team can become a nation for now. It certainly helps them grow the team, and that's still God's game plan for now, grow the team.
So God lets this one leader in particular become the leader by which all other leaders will be judged forevermore, David. Interestingly, he kind of sucks at it most of the time. He sleeps around, kills a good guy to cover up the fact that he's sleeping around. Not exactly the kind of plumb line you expect God to be dropping from heaven.
But here's the thing. David pours his heart out to God. He's the guy you think of when you hear a lot of that Dear God poetry, like, teach me, O Lord, the way of your statutes. And so when God sends one of God's first human messengers, Nathan, to pour God's heart out to David, David listens. David messes up. But when God uses Nathan to remind him about lesson one, I love you, and lesson two, remember I got your back, David listens. He accepts it as best he can, and that's the plumb line. For God so loved the team that he let them become a nation and have a king and mess up in all the ways that kings and nations always do. For God so loved the team that he gave them what they wanted, corrupt as it was going to be, and then worked with it.
Of course, David's not the only one who can make a mess of the kingdom from time to time. His story is just a small example of the big one. People get promiscuous with other gods and selfish with each other. And so God turns Nathan's work into a recurring thing, hires a role player for the team every once in a while that does the dirty work. Amos, Hosea, Micah, guys that only the Amish are brave enough to name their children after anymore. And all the while, the team waits for the big game to break out. Well, at least some of them do.
God, when does this team conquer the league like you said it would, they ask.
And others couldn't really care anymore. Life without big game pressure is pretty comfortable. But both groups are about to get a wake-up call that they can't ignore.
Just when the team has finally grown from one couple to a family to a people to a nation, it all falls apart.
Another team sweeps in, and there is no mercy.
We're talking worst-case scenario.
If you're not dead, you're chained up and drug out of your home into someone else's land.
Terrible, terrible stuff.
And of course, this little remnant of the team's just wondering, was that the big game? Did we lose the big game? I mean, everything has got to be called into question, right? God built this team to win. God promised to deliver victory. And now this?
So everyone's waiting to see what God has to say for God's self. At least those who still believe that God didn't die with their husbands, wives, mothers, fathers, and kids back in the promised land.
And those who are actually brave enough to believe that God is alive and listening aren't much of a treat to hear either.
My eyes are spent with weeping. My stomach churns. My bile pours out onto the ground, they write. Or, oh God, will you bless the person who takes out those slave drivers' babies and bashes their brains?
That Dear God poetry is not all about lying in green pastures and climbing each other's sexy pomegranate trees anymore, I'll tell you that much.
But eventually, God sends more Amish namesakes around to them in exile to deliver some messages. Guys like Jeremiah and Isaiah.
Firstly, they say, even if this battle was the big game, it's not like you were following the playbooks closely enough to win it anymore anyway. You knew that if you got too comfortable, God was going to send you packing.
Secondly, they say, you recognize that God never promised that this would happen when and how you expected it to, right?
So thirdly, they say, you may as well settle in here. Remember, the ultimate plan was to be a blessing to other nations. You sure learned how to bless yourselves. Why don't you work on that other part for a while? Seek the peace of those other teams' cities.
And fourthly and fifthly, God loves you and God's got your back. So, splintered, shattered team spend some time thinking about it all. they come to the conclusion that maybe they hadn't been following that playbook very well after all. Maybe they brought this on themselves. Maybe they should use this as an opportunity to do a better job of all that. And so a lot of them do. And after a few generations, some of them even end up staggering back to the promised land to survey the damage and start over.
But still, was this it?
It seemed like a small victory compared to what they'd had before, and an even smaller victory compared to what they had expected.
They sure didn't feel like a team that had conquered the league or changed the game or brought every team into perfectly balanced relationship with themselves, each other, everything, and God.
What in the world do you do with a reality like that?
And it came to pass that big government forced an unwed pregnant woman and her scandalized boyfriend to make the long journey to Bethlehem, where nobody was interested in taking them in.
And behold, a baby was born in a stable, the only place they could find to lay their heads.
Angels attended.
Kings brought gifts from afar.
And in that stable, the stump of what had been the family tree sprouted something unbelievable.
Jesus.
And God's plan is back in action.
Because this kid grows up and he grabs a few stragglers from this once impressive team and gathers them around that old playbook.
Except nobody's used the playbook like this before. Pages are turned upside down and turned around. The purpose of the play is explained, and then all the X's and O's and arrows are erased. Erased. And then redrawn to fit the purpose again.
Who in the world gets to reinterpret the playbook like this? Who does this guy think he is? Well, who do you say that I am? He mostly replies.
Who indeed? This guy heals the blind. He casts out demons. He raises the dead.
He also has this annoying knack for talking in riddles and turning things upside down. In fact, he seems to be gunning for some sort of world where everything is turned upside down.
Do you have a huge mansion, young man? Give it away.
Are you poor and run down, my daughter? You'll get it all someday.
It's confusing, frankly. But if his life and teachings are an abstract painting, then there is some vaguely familiar shape to it all. He talks a lot about a kingdom he's brought to town, a kingdom that starts to sound a lot like that paradise from the very beginning. A kingdom where all the love and respect is balanced and restored, where our broken relationship with God has finally been healed. A kingdom where that big plan that kept bubbling up, the one where enemies were forgiven, homes were shared, and God's goodness was for everyone, where that big plan is not just a side note, but it's the main event. It's the whole point.
And suddenly, all this kingdom talk starts to sound really familiar. Is this the big game? Is this guy going to lead the kingdom back to its former glory and beyond, and all the promises that have become distant, painful memories, kind of embarrassing remnants of a better time?
Unfortunately, those who might be threatened by that question, they're asking it too, and needless to say, they are not so excited about it.
So just as things are getting exciting, they turn deadly.
There's enough time for a trial, a joke of a trial at best, but before you know it, this heir to the throne of David is nailed to a tree and left there to die.
And yet, 3 days later, there he is, up from the grave and in the flesh.
Long enough to hang out for a while, say hi, and check out these scars.
And keep this thing going, it's yours.
And so his former students... Oh, I'm sorry. And check you later, I'm gonna float up to heaven now.
And so again, it's gotta beg the question, who is this guy?
So his former students do some thinking and some researching.
They check out that stuff written down by all those prophets of old, and just like Jesus showed them to do, they turn them around to see what new things they might say.
And lo and behold, the picture starts to emerge again.
A kingdom. A king.
This was the big game. Jesus is the king that won the big game. God's plan is in action. Israel's shattering defeat has transformed through this Jesus guy into a victory for everyone, a kingdom where every relationship is being restored. Not the kind of kingdom we're used to, where sinners and enemy nations get obliterated, but the kind of kingdom that could only exist if its true king could win, not through force, but through self-sacrifice, humility, and grace.
But there's something more, something hard to pin down, but an unrelenting thought.
Nobody could deliver on this Jesus guy's promises of healing and salvation but God. Nobody can conquer death but God.
This guy was that.
A God person. A person God.
Those aren't quite it.
All God as a human. All God, all human.
Come to earth to take the throne.
Be the king.
Deliver on that promise by announcing God's kingdom, showing it to us, asking us to commit to its salvation and live in it, and capping it off by conquering death.
Happy conclusion and all, but they have no idea what to do with it.
The guy's gone, floated back up to heaven now.
Jesus might be king of the world, but an absent king is only as good as a dead king.
But then it rains down.
It's been tough enough to come to the conclusion that there's God the Father and God the Jesus. No, wait, God the Son. Yes, that works.
It's been tough enough to figure out that God's a Father, God's a Son, but suddenly there's God the invisible pouring down into their hearts as clear as the miracles it performs.
God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit, the essence of the King, furthering that kingdom.
And that Spirit's not just filling up their hearts.
She's spilling out of their hearts and so far beyond them that they can barely keep up with the flood.
Spilling out onto Jews from every corner of the world.
Spilling out onto a super unclean black eunuch.
Spilling out onto an entire household of super unclean Gentiles.
Spilling out even onto their archenemy Saul.
Well, who can prevent us from being baptized? All these dirty brand new Jesus lovers keep asking.
Who indeed? I mean, this is the kind of thing God promised from the beginning, isn't it? But I guess it's legitimately hard to see if you've been on the team for a while. So the Spirit helps with that, too.
Foreskin or no foreskin, the playbook sure said no.
The Spirit says yes.
Yeah, right, and I bet we can eat bacon now, too.
The Spirit says, sure, wrap all your favorite foods in it and have a heart attack over it for all I care.
Okay, but how do we even do this community thing together? We're all so different. That girl snores during the sermon. And that guy's got long hair and like 3 unicorn tattoos, I heard. And that family, well, one time they invited us over for supper, but I think they were probably expecting us to bring a salad, but they like didn't say to bring a salad, but then they didn't have a salad. And then they like kept mentioning how beautiful the lettuce in our garden looked. And so like when I see them in the foyer at church, they like do this thing where they're smiling, but you could tell they're just trying to smile, and really underneath that is this look that makes you think, oh, I guess I'm a salad freeloader now.
Goodness sake, just listen to the Spirit.
So as they listen to the Spirit and chase the Spirit, the community works out its kinks, and the community meets new communities in Jerusalem,
Rome,
center of that old team's world, and beyond.
For God so loved the world that he gave it a team. His Son as an upside-down king, and the Spirit to share that upside-down kingdom with each other and to the ends of the earth.
Like they went, now you go.
But maybe one more thing.
Okay, a guy named John, a real artsy type who talks in pictures, wants to get in the last word.
The guy is super hard to understand.
But the main point is what's important.
God wins.
Loving wins.
This is over. And this isn't over yet. Your home, the kingdom, is here, but it's clearly not totally built yet.
People still mess up. People still get messed up for reasons they don't deserve.
So here's what you should do. Live in it. Cry about it. Enjoy it.
But if you want to do these things right, listen to John's last words so you can expect it.
Someday, no more evil.
Someday, perfect healing.
Someday, paradise.
Every day, live like you really expect it.
Every day, live like you're already a part of it.
Because you are.
Choose to live like you're already a part of it because you already are.
No matter what you've done or what's been done to you,
you are a part of this story.
We are part of this story, so share it.
Your ugly stuff.
Everyone's ugly stuff.
Your ho-hum, this is boring stuff.
Everyone's ho-hum, this is boring stuff.
Your best stuff.
The best of everyone's stuff.
Your real stuff.
Is God's stuff.
Is the story.
So those who have ears.
Listen.
And those who have voices.
Share
and
it.
And those who have life.
Live it.
This story is God's.
And you're in it.
So live it.
You should share that story given that way all around the world, but you can't leave Albany. Our hymn of response is Lamp of Our Feet. We are going to be singing this to the tune, O God, Our Help in Ages.